Well, obviously, a lot of the things I believe about God and worship and life, I sow into these worship songs that I write, but it's always great to have a chance to unpack a little bit more of the scriptures. One of the things I love doing at our church, I'm one of the pastors at our church, is we always teach and preach our way through entire books of the Bible. We don't teach topically at our church. And our theory is that we'll eventually get all the topics by working our way through things like the Gospels or, you know, whatever it is. So I want to take you through a little section of the Gospel of John tonight. But before I do that, I'll give you a little bit of context. I'm 45 now, and I've been married to my wife for almost 27 years. So do the math. I got married quite young. In fact, you want to throw those pictures that I brought? Those of you at the conference saw this, so you can. Those of you that weren't at the conference, there's my wife Joyce, and we were having a family celebration in Whistler Village. You guys watch the Olympics, Winter Olympics, like whatever year ago? No. What's the Summer Olympics for you? Of course, it's on that. Wow, the revelation just hit. It's like you guys have the seasons right and the rest of the world has the seasons wrong, I tell you. Well, anyway, there's my wife. She doesn't look like she's had six children, does she? And so you go to the next picture. That's my four girls and my wife. Joy in the front. She's 16 and her twin sister is at the back, Mercy. Joy wants to be a chef. She's starting to cook a lot of our family meals and she does amazing. And then Esther, my 21-year-old, is right behind her, and she's trained to work with handicapped students. And my wife, Joyce, and my daughter, Rachel, who just got married, and other twin, Mercy. And then we have two amazing boys. You want to go to the next? We have two boys, Benjamin and Isaiah, and they both have a condition called Fragile X syndrome. So they have almost no speech, but lots of love. They're huggers. They, you know, so my son, Ben, has just turned 20, and he's a precious gift. And then on to the next slide. This is our second son, Isaiah. He's 12, and he has three words. No, mama, and me. This is really the only three words you need. And, right? And he can make those three words mean many things. I keep on trying. You know, he comes and calls me mama. And I'm like, no. Dad, da, you know, da, da. You know, and like, he hasn't quite gotten that far. He's 12. He just got toilet trained, which was a huge, oh my goodness. I'm like 22 years into changing nappies every day, multiple times. And it was a huge joy to get that one figured out with many rewards of lots of crisps. Like, I mean, you just, that kid can devour a can of Pringles or something. And then I have one more, and this is the wedding of my daughter and on our property at our house. We're just outside of Vancouver, British Columbia, and that's my son-in-law, Luke, right in the middle, and he's a hero of mine because he married into a family knowing the risks of Fragile X syndrome in the genetic line. And he's an up and coming worship leader, songwriter, and just a very, very compassionate human being. In fact, one time last year we had him doing some care of Isaiah, and it was before Isaiah was toilet trained fully. And he had him for a few hours, and I showed up at Luke's apartment to pick Isaiah up, and I knocked on the door, and there was no answer. I thought, oh, okay. So finally I go in, and I go, Luke, Isaiah. And then all of a sudden, Luke sticks his head around the corner, and he's got tissues stuffed in his nostrils, hanging out. We'll be there right away, you know. Like, that guy's got class, man, I tell you. Like, oh, my goodness. And, you know, just to say, you can take the family indulgence off here, and to say that I think all of us in our life go through some challenging things that we wouldn't choose in advance. But at the end of our journey, maybe looking back, we would go, well, I would choose that suffering because I see what it shapes in me. But in advance, we would never pick it, would we? And I can guarantee one thing, that every single person in this room is suffering in some way because you're alive. The only time you stop suffering is when you're dead. Seriously. I mean, we all have the pain of living in a fallen world. And God gives us comfort and courage on the journey, but we still all suffer. And I want to just share something from the Gospel of John. So if you have your Bible, why don't you turn to John chapter 1. And I want to just share something from about the first 14, 15 verses. And we'll read it together in a moment, but the verse that's been really grabbing me is verse 14, and we'll read the whole section, but just to say, this the Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. We have seen His glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And I think that the journey of John is really a journey of grace and truth. And I don't know about you, but I can't live without those things, those two things being in loving partnership. Grace and truth. Because truth without grace condemns. Truth without grace stands at the high moral ground and looks down at sinners with superiority. Grace without truth misleads. It offers false comfort. One of my good friends who's co-written a couple of the songs, like Whatever Comes that we sang tonight, is a doctor and a friend of mine, Steve Mitchinson, a British doctor. And he's transitioning out of being a GP into being a palliative care specialist. That's a doctor that works with patients at the end of life. And he's very passionate about seeing good spiritual care come to those at the end of their life. And he was telling me recently about an encounter he had with a hospital chaplain. And about people and chaplains, literally, that will say, well, we don't want to upset or do anything other than one thing, as we want to bring them comfort. So even if, you know, he was talking about this description where this chaplain said, you know, the elderly person is dying and the daughter's there, and the daughter looks to the chaplain and says, does my mother need Jesus, or can she just, you know, die at peace? And the chaplain goes, because he doesn't want to offend her, no, she doesn't need Jesus. She just needs, you know. And that's what I mean by, it's like it get to a place where we're just so whatever, we just offer false comfort because we don't want to rock any boat. And of course, you wonder what people do on the other side of that. And so, but see, something happens when grace and truth get married, as it did in Jesus. Because that's that perfect union of grace and truth, and we see it in Jesus. And this is maybe an obvious thing to say, but unless people can't hear the truth unless if they don't first sense grace from you. So we want to declare and receive the truth, but we want to do that with grace. And when we need them both. And when we say this, we need it in the same order that Jesus came to reveal. Jesus, full of grace and truth. Grace leading the way into truth. So, maybe, you know, thinking about grace and truth interacting, can we embrace the truth? We were singing before, the holiness, the holy, holy, holy God. Can we be passionate about living holy lives and still be a people about grace? And I think, obviously, Jesus is the best mentor to help us and teach us. He embodies it perfectly. And I think John is a great guide the disciple who Jesus loved, who stayed near Jesus through his life, present at his death. In fact, there's no New Testament author who spent more time with Jesus than John. I find it sometimes interesting that so much of the preaching in the modern church is based on Paul and his epistles, and that's all good, but we often don't spend time with the person who actually spent the most time with Jesus, and that's John. And I think there's something unique about the Gospel of John, and I'm just going to read you a little description of the difference, just so that you, as we go into this, I'm really passionate. Whenever I read something in the Scriptures, I want to know the background. Right, I want to know what was going on. I want to know what the first hearers were thinking and feeling and what their framework was when they heard these words the first time. And so here's just a very quick, and you've probably done this many times at your church, but forgive me if you know this, but it just helps me to put myself in this John passage. Matthew wrote his gospel for his fellow Jews, and his emphasis was that Jesus fulfilled Old Testament prophecy. Mark wrote his gospel primarily for the Romans, who were very, they were Roman. Matthew emphasized the king. Mark emphasized the servant. Interesting. Mark's emphasis was the servant message to the Romans. The message of Mark is very focused on ministering to needy people. Luke wrote his gospel for the Greeks, and he introduced them to a phrase where you find most in the gospel of Luke, and that is the Son of Man. That connection. But John, he's of course called the beloved disciple, wrote a book for both Jews and Gentiles, presenting Jesus as the Son of God. So the first three Gospels are primarily about what happened in Jesus, and the Gospel of John is primarily about what it means. Any of you students out there that love figuring out what things mean? Just me. I'm kind of a guy. Like I try and sort of figure out how things work and what does it mean. So maybe that's why. Maybe that's just my thing. I just love the Gospel of John because I want to know what it means. And of course, you know, at the end of John, he sort of says, well, this is why I wrote this, right? You know, those of you that know the gospel know John 20, when he says, he's talking to Thomas, and he says, because you have seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, which is just the Greek word for Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And that word life, that you may have life, is used 36 times in the Gospel of John. No other New Testament book uses it more than 17. So I think the Gospel of John is a book about life. And it's a book about how grace and truth lead us into life. So let's, can we just look at this? Do we have that on the screen? John chapter 1? And, there we go. And this is from the new NIV, whatever. There's New International Version, then they had another one, and then that had controversy, so finally they've released the New International Version. But I like this translation, so, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life. And that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light so that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world didn't recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him, that's John the Baptist. He cried out saying, "This is the one I spoke about whom I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.'" And of course we know chronologically that naturally John the Baptist was born before Jesus, so he's speaking about the bigger picture here. "Out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of grace already given, for the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." I'll end there for now. Why does John start his account of Jesus way back with creation? It's almost an exact parallel with the Hebrew Genesis 1, "In the beginning." And then John 1 starts, "In the beginning," in Greek. And I think John starts there. Remember, because John is totally focused on meaning. What does this life mean? What does Jesus mean? What does his coming mean? And he's making a very bold connection. He's connecting it totally back to creation. And he's saying, this is how it began. There was this quote in Time, I was reading an article on a current upheaval in astrophysics. I love this quote. "The experts do not know for sure how old or how big the universe is. They do not know what most of it is made of. They do not know in any detail how it began or how it will end." That's the experts in astrophysics. John knows. And that's actually hard for some modern people to take in. We're so used to a culture of not knowing because of the grand, vast mysteries of our universe. And John just comes along and says, well, all these people, he knows. And he wants his readers to know that Jesus was the instrument of creation described in Genesis. But his focus is, he wants you to know that Jesus is the instrument of new creation. The one who recreates, redeems, and rescues people made in the image of God back to their original created purpose, full of beauty, full of purpose, and full of light. About 10 days ago, we did a little event in our town. I'm on the board of a local charity called Life Haven, which is all about helping women in recovery from addictions. Some of them have prostitution backgrounds. Some of them have just different kinds of troubles, but usually it involves addiction. And so my good friend Teresa leads this charity, and she's also a songwriter, and she's written amazing songs for this type of community. And so we did a little concert, and I was playing along and singing, and she was doing this wonderful new song she's written called "Kiss of Life," which is this description of how every girl dreams about being a princess when they're little, and Disney feeds on that very, very cleverly. But she's written this song about this, and that how only God can come and bring us the kiss of life that will bring us to life, really bring us to life. And I was playing the guitar and I was watching this, and there was about 60 women there in from various recovery houses. And all of a sudden I just got so hit with the beauty of what I was seeing, the real beauty. And I looked over to my left and there was a native Aboriginal woman. She was probably in her 50s, and you could take one look at her face and you knew she had had a horrific life. Right next to her was a redhead, probably maybe in her 20s. And as these two women were listening to this song, they literally linked arms and were just listening, and they were receiving it. And it was just this incredible picture. So the song finished, and I just stopped before the concert went on, and I said to these women, I said, the Father wants you to know, you're so beautiful. And as soon as I said it, this native woman just began to weep. And I realized in that moment, I wonder if this woman has ever heard in a pure way from a man that she's beautiful, in a way that takes nothing from her but just gives to her. And this is what the work of new creation is. Such an incredible privilege to stand there and watch these women. You could just see it in their faces. They are becoming new creations. It's a hard journey. Anybody who knows addiction knows it ain't overnight. It's a hard journey. But that's the kind of thing that Jesus came. And of course, Jesus, I mean, talk about a redeemer of women. And religion generally has always been, seems to partner in some way with keeping women not fully released. And Jesus doesn't do that. He releases them. He redeems them. He recreates them. And Genesis and John 1 are both a study on light and darkness, right? Creation, light is first. If you don't have light, the scientists tell us, you have no life. If the sun went out, what would happen? We would all die, and every plant, every living thing on earth would die. So what is the very first thing that God says in creation? Let there be light. Of course, when God says something, it happens. When God says something, it happens. But people created in the image of God rebelled against God. And that rebellion leads into darkness. And the earth and its people, in some ways, it feels like are returning almost to, in some places, a pre-creation chaos and darkness, and leads to being enslaved. And so God sends someone to prepare the way for the light to return. And that, of course, in this passage talks about John the Baptist. He was a witness who testifies of the light. He's like a man with his hand on the light switch. He's not the creator of the electrical energy. He just flicks the switch. And that's what John the Baptist came. It's like in that time, it's like God came and said, once more, let there be light. And the thing is, this gets repeated over and over again. And I can feel it even in this room, as different ones of you are saying yes to God, and you're serving other people, and you're in your own way, you're like, you've all got your hands on the light switch. Because every time you say yes to God, every time you show somebody compassion, every time you pray in the power of the Spirit for somebody, you've got your hand on the light switch. The power is not you. That's why there's no room for, elevating people and being all proud about this amazing thing that happens. As Angus Buchan said at the conference, we're all just nobodies. And I would add, we're nobodies that God is madly in love with. But so here you have this in John 1, you have Jesus coming to his own, the one who said, let there be light. He comes to his own and his own don't receive him. And I don't understand this. I mean, how come they didn't sense it was him? Have you ever asked yourself that when you read this? When you see the way he was mistreated, and when you see the way that the people who's the religious leaders who spent all the time in the scriptures studied, how come they didn't realize it was him? I mean, I can understand why the modern Jews don't receive Yeshua. And because of the way Christians in the name of Christ have treated them for centuries. And that needs to change, and it is changing. But I'm more puzzled about these first century Jews. But here's the thing. I guess they too are like us. They are so enamored with power and greatness. They couldn't recognize that their king would come with such humility and such a complete disregard for human power structures. A complete disregard. And so that's why they missed it. And this is why, verse 14, I love this verse. This is the gospel. Verse 14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. He was made flesh. And I'm not going to, sarx is the word, it's flesh and bones. It's not flesh as in sin. It's just the physical reality. He was made flesh. He was raised in the flesh. And God has no problem with physical things. He made the physical world. Sometimes, C.S. Lewis, I love this. This is a funny quote from C.S. Lewis. There's no use trying to be more spiritual than God. I mean, it's just, C.S. just says it, you know? God never meant man to be a purely spiritual creature. That's why he uses material things like bread and wine to put the new life into us. We may think it kind of crude, unspiritual. God doesn't. He invented eating. He likes matter. He invented it. I know some muddle-headed Christians have talked as if Christianity thought that sex or the body or pleasure were bad in themselves, but they are wrong. Christianity is almost the only one of the great religions which thoroughly approves of the body, which believes that matter is good and that some kind of body is going to be given to us, even in heaven, is going to be an essential part of our happiness, our beauty, and our energy. Yeah. Preach it, C.S. This word in verse 14, the word dwelling, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling. This to me is so key. Because the Greek word translated is eskenosen, which means booths or tabernacles. But when you hear the word tabernacle, you need to understand it's a humble, it's a little, it's a little tabernacle. Better word for us, at least in our culture, is tent. Do you guys go tenting in South Africa in summer? What do you call it? Camping? Oh no, we call it camping too, but we call it tenting. Camping with tents? Well, I'm gonna get myself in trouble, I know it. I'm just gonna say something innocently, and you're gonna like, oh boy. So, here's how I think this verse should be translated. The Word became flesh. This is the Dirksen translation. God came and set up his tent next to ours. Now, you know, when you go camping, I don't know what your camp places are like, but a lot of our places in Canada are like way too cozy for me. In other words, there's like a tent here, and there's like a couple of feet, and then there's another tent here. And you know what tents are like with sound? You get the point. So here's God coming and setting up his tent next to ours. And he doesn't have a problem with that. That's what we were singing before, Holy, Holy, Holy God. And I remember that song came out of a season where I was just so earnestly desiring a fresh God revelation. But as I was doing that and I was singing those, I remember days, I just spent days just singing holy, holy over and again. And then it was like, but the credible thing about our God who is holy is he comes and sets up his tent right beside ours. And we ain't exactly pure and clean and right in every way. And he has no problem associating with us. Does salvation come to us through segregation and separation? Or does salvation come to us through association? That's the gospel. He comes and sets up his tent right next to us. The Jewish feast of Sukkot, celebrated every year, marked the exodus from Egypt, celebrated on the 15th month of Tishrei, I think is how they say it, late September to late October. And it said this, you shall live in booths, same word, 7 days, all citizens in Israel shall live in booths in order that future generations may know that I made the Israelite people live in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. And this is something else interesting about this verse, because it says, we have seen his glory. So he comes and sets up his tent right beside ours, and as a result of that, we see his glory. And to the Jew, you have to understand, you could not see God and live. Seeing God meant instant death. So here's John underlying, God becomes flesh so we can see him, even his glory. And still live. In fact, God did this so we would live and not die. That's the whole point. Remember that moment back in Exodus where Moses is saying, now show me your glory. You remember that story? And it's, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you. I'll proclaim my name. And then God says, but you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. John's gospel is saying we are now seeing God. And instead of dying, we're brought to life. Put it this way, expression comes to me. We're staring at the sun and we're not going blind. Why? Because of grace. Because of grace. We are seeing God. He's no longer sequestered away in the Holy of Holies, in the temple, or in the highest heavens. We see God because his tent is right next to ours. And I'm telling you, this continues to this day. It does. It just happens through other people who have the Spirit of Jesus and the Spirit of God in them. They just don't, they're not able to as completely and fully represent God because they're not God, but they have God's life in them. And when they make that choice to follow God, then we see a little Christ, so to speak, in that tent right next to ours. And every single one of us come to faith because in some way God sets his tent up next to ours. And that, whoever that person is or however that present comes into our life, they don't judge us and write us off because we're a mess. They give us hope. They just say simple words to us. God forgives. And that was something I felt like tonight. There's several of you here tonight that just simply need to know God forgives. That's the gospel. That's about the heart of it that I can see even just from this passage. Can you guys, Callum, Brian, the rest of the band, you want to guys come up and join me here? We'll do maybe a song or two and then we'll give you a chance to respond. I shared at the conference on Isaiah 40. Isaiah 40 says this, verse 4, every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed. And all mankind together will see it. And it's interesting that this passage also refers to the glory. The revelation of the glory. I think one of the reasons why the original people alive in the time of Jesus missed it because they thought glory would be glorious. It would be spectacular. It would overpower them. It would, you know, shock and awe them. And instead, here comes this man that's described in the scriptures as, you know, having nothing special about his appearance, who served the common people, who was so uninterested in the power structures of the day that he just simply told the truth in whatever situation he was in. And they missed it. And so I think Jesus is still the same. And the sad thing is sometimes I miss it. Sometimes I miss God. Because I'm actually expecting and looking for the wrong thing. And I've forgotten John 1:14. I've forgotten that the Word became and in a sense still becomes flesh and sets up his tent next to mine. And I'm looking for something so big and so, like, something so mystical and something so that I miss the little things. And this is one of the incredible things about having mentally handicapped sons. It's because they live in the moment and they live to give and receive love. And every morning my son, when he wakes up, he's on a love mission. And all he's got to do is find somebody to give a hug because he just has to. And I like thinking things through. As I told you, I like thinking about what things mean. But I think there's something more important, and that is just to receive the love as it comes. And the love sometimes comes through very ordinary, broken people. The God loves those that are handicapped and special needs among us. And if you don't have those kinds of people in your church and in your life, you are poorer for it. Because they will demonstrate to you what love is all about. Are you guys plugged in? Okay. We got time to do a couple songs, and then we'll... Okay. So Father, we thank you that you don't leave us alone, that you come and set up your tent next to ours, and you come full of grace and truth. And that you speak over us, you're forgiven. You are welcome. You can come in. Don't stay away. Don't stay away because of your shame. This is my Father's house, and you are welcome here. Every daughter, every son, completely welcome.